The following is brought to you by the Leave It in the Ring Podcast Network. All boxing, no filter.
Greetings and welcome to the Boxing Esquire Podcast. Welcome to another edition of the Boxing Esquire Podcast, presented by The Ring and RingTV.com and distributed by the Leave It in the Ring Network. My guest on this episode is one of the best writers in the sport, Mr. Cliff Rold. He's a founding member of the independent media-run boxing ratings organization, the Transnational Boxing Ratings Board, which I respect tremendously. He's also one of the managing editors of one of the leading boxing sites, BoxingScene.com. We spoke about his journey in the sport and how he ended up founding the Transnational Boxing Ratings Board, along with a couple of other writers, Springs Toledo and Tim Starks. And we got into the art of rating fighters and the TBRB's process, the state of the game, and a couple of other really interesting subjects. Really hope you enjoy it. Cliff's a really interesting guy and has a lot to say about the sport. It's a true pleasure to introduce my guest this week. Very excited to have one of the founders of the independent media-run boxing ratings organization, the Transnational Boxing Ratings Board. And he's also the managing editor of one of the leading boxing sites, BoxingScene.com, and one of the premier writers and thinkers in the sport. Mr. Cliff Rold, welcome to the Boxing Esquire Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Kurt. Happy Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day, my man. So do you use the nickname 24 Karat anymore or no?
No, it's been a long time since that. you'd have to be able to remember that. Of course, I got started. The first website I really worked for, I had had a few things published early on. I had a fictional short story that was run on the Cyber Boxing Zone. And I wrote a little bit for a couple startup websites, but the first place I got hired was writing at ringtalk.com, and the editor there, Pedro Fernandez, gave me the nickname 24 Karat. Love that guy. He taught me a lot, and then from there I got hired at Boxing Scene, and I've been there since 2007. So
wow. Well, let's take it back a little bit. So growing up, I think you told me you were from Cali. How did you develop an interest in boxing?
I got to be honest, it was just one of those things that, you know, everybody got together at my grandparents' house, you know, back when having HBO was a big deal. Whoever had it in the family, everybody could go over and watch the fights. So the family would gather over at my grandparents', and I didn't watch a lot of it, you know, for the first 6 or 7 years of my life. I wasn't sitting down to watch sports. And then, you know, I remember one night my dad said, "Hey, you're going to watch this this Mike Tyson kid. You're going to watch tonight." And I said, "Okay, I'll watch." And I spent two rounds watching Mike Tyson fight Trevor Burbick. And that was it. I was in love with boxing from there forward. And I would spend a lot of Saturday nights and Friday nights, weeknights, back when there were more weeknight fights, watching boxing over my grandfather's house. And so that's what we did. I started buying magazines and buying up old history books and just got sort of obsessed with it at a fan level. There wasn't really a place to do it in town, so I never pursued it, but it was something as a fan that I just cultivated this interest in, and it followed me my whole life. I a couple pockets of time when I was a teenager where I stopped watching for a while, and I just always came back to it until it was just what it's become for me. It's one of the things I enjoy most in life is to watch a good fight.
Absolutely. So you said you started at Ring Talk initially. Was that like the late 90s or so?
No, I was right in there. So that would have been around 2003, 2004. Okay. And so I was there for 2 or 3 years. And then I went over and started working for Rick in 2007.
Okay. Well, I mean, I know you had a few gigs in between there. Cause I know, yeah, like you said, the Cyber Boxing Zone, which for me was like pretty much the first website I found when I first got on the net in the 90s. I know you wrote some really cool, I think you were, I don't know, kind of like, you know, like a comparative, like generational comparative things for like the heavyweights and so on. Like, you know, who's like,
some of that stuff. And, you know, I look back on it. I mean, it's been so long ago now. You look back on it now and And I realized, you know, how much more research I've done and how much more I've sort of learned about how to compare the different eras, or at least how I think about it. So some of it I look back on and it's not as good as I would like it to be. But it's, yeah, I wrote a few pieces for them, and, you know, I just always, I always got along, with Steve Gordon at their site. And I still, every once in a while, will email with Tracy Callis, who I know still does stuff for them. But they were great, and they're still out there. It's a great resource for fans who want to dig into some historical articles and some great research that's been done. It's mostly a static website these days, more of an archive, but a lot of the stuff that's in those archives is fantastic. I recommend it to anybody.
Right, right. So it was while you were at, I think you wrote for, did you write for Max Boxing for a little while too, or?
Well, sort of. So what happened was, for a brief period of time, Boxing Scene and Max Boxing were working on, they were doing something together. And so some of us that were at Boxing Scene were some of our weekly work was added to the rotation at Max Boxing. But I was working for Max Boxing by proxy through Boxing Scene. And then when they didn't keep doing what they were doing, people like me, Jake Donovan, we all stayed with Boxing Scene, after that all kind of washed out.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. I was wondering how that worked. Okay. So while you're at Boxing Scene, I guess, they decided, you know, the Ring reached out to you to put you on, the prestigious, Ring's rating panel. At some point, at what point did you join there?
Oh goodness, I don't really remember, to be honest with you. I think it may have been around the time that I started writing for Rick. I can't really remember. Maybe 2007, 2008. I'd really have to go back and look. But it was when Nigel Collins was still the editor there. I believe he may have reached out personally on that, or Eric Raskin may have reached out to me. But they asked me if I would, you know, chime in on this ratings panel they were putting together. I was like, sure, why not? And, you know, I'd been pestering them for years about the lineage of the flyweight championship. I think, you know, like, hey, you guys have to fix this. I'm like the one of the two people on earth who probably cared, but regardless, stuff like that. And they asked me to sit in, and I was like, sure. And then, you know, management changed there. I stayed on with the new crew for a while. And, that was always a lot of fun. I mean, you just weighed in and gave your opinion on who should move where. And some weeks you were more excited about it than others, you know, depending on what the fight was, or the result, or the outcome. But, you know, it's fun. It's fun stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But at a certain point, you and Springs Toledo and Tim Starks all kind of left. Was around 2012. You guys all left, because there was a change in the rules regarding crowning champs. Talk about the decision to take off.
All right. So it was pretty simple, right? So when it just was an issue of, they put on paper, and I don't think it ever even came to fruition, right? But there had always been sort of an objection, like a purist objection, to the rule as it was anyways, which was, if the title was vacant, you could have number one fight number three in the ratings, and that could fill a title under certain circumstances, right? In other words, it was debatable. Well, then it became, I can't remember the exact wording, but it expanded it out where it looked like on paper you could potentially have like a number two fight, a number five for the vacant title. And to my mind anyways, you know, if you're going that far, and frankly, the rules don't read that way anymore at Ring, but for that period of time, at that point, it's like, well, why rate fighters? Like, that was kind of how I was thinking about it. Like, you know, why have the ratings at all if that's what you're going to do? And it was just something that we didn't agree with. And for me, here's the thing, right? Like, I'm not trying to, you know, make any money off of, you know, providing sort of press ratings. I know that some people don't care about them at all. You know, they're looking at the reality of the sport. I mean, the fighters sometimes care, but often don't. I mean, if I'm a fighter, I want to be rated in the top five by the WBC. I want to be their mandatory contender, because that's how I can get an actual physical belt that I can make money with, right? So I understand that part. But I think, from an outsider perspective, you still want to have sort of some objective ratings that people can take a look at. And that history part of me that I like, you know, there should be a place where we can look where we can try to capture as best as possible what the lines of the titles are, who are history's champions at any given particular time. And I thought that the change in the ratings, this was just my personal take at the time, like that change in the ratings would really limit the ability to do that. And so I wasn't crazy about that. And then me and Springs and Tim, we started talking about another idea, and that's kind of the germ that turned into TBRB.
Right. I mean, it seems like the ring belt has gained a little more respect the last couple of years. I see that, you know, some champs kind of, you know, crave or talk about the ring belt, although it's still, obviously it's not, you know, anywhere near the magnitude of the sanctioning bodies belts. But, I mean, do you think, you know, Golden Boy, you know, having, you know, owning the ring now, does that put like a taint over the belt, or do you think that conflict of interest can be overcome or mitigated, or how you feel about it?
I think it did. I think at the time, and this was something that was discussed at the time, right? And I know that this podcast runs off of Ring's website.
That's right.
Right. I know it's not to disparage anybody, you know, but I mean, obviously, it has the look of a conflict of interest that a promoter would own a publication that then is giving out titles. You know, obviously, and there was that even before, you know, the change in the rules that some of us objected to. So, you know, it looked that way, but my experience with it, sitting on the ring panel is there wasn't a lot of, pressure put on anybody. There was no pressure put on anybody. There was nothing like that where you were like, oh, you know, here's Golden Boy sort of dictating to us what we're going to do on this ratings panel. None of that ever happened. And if you look at Ring's ratings right now, and I don't think the 2-5 rule even exists anymore. If you look in the magazine or online, it's back to, you know, 1 versus 3 is sort of as extreme as they're going to go to fill a vacant title. So they've kind of gone back. But because I looked this up the other day, I was just curious how it read now. And, you know, you look at it and I apologize. I just lost my train of thought. Sorry, Kirk.
Well, you were looking at the ring rules?
Yeah. No. I was trying to – I was getting somewhere else. I know you can remix this, so sorry about that.
We'll move on. Yeah, we're talking about conflicts of interest, but no, that's cool.
So you go – if you look at rings rate – sorry. Here's where I was going. Cut and restart here. Like if you look at the way Ring's ratings read right now, and you compare them to the ratings at ESPN or the ratings at Boxing Monthly or even the ratings at TBRB, you're not going to see this huge disparity in the ratings. I mean, there's going to be differences sometimes. I mean, sometimes where we are as in terms of who we think the number one fighter is versus Ring or ESPN or any of the other press outlets that provide sort of non-sanctioning body, more independent ratings. I mean, they're all kind of within a certain standard deviation of each other. So, you know, I mean, do I see reflected in Ring's ratings, like, here's the Golden Boy influence? No. Do I think Doug Fisher or any of the people who sit on their panel, I know some of them, Adam Abramowitz, I think, is on their panel right now. Like, are those people chiming in to try to, you know, influence that way? No, I don't see it that way. But the appearance of a conflict of interest and the actual existence of one are not always the same thing. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So in November 2012, you know, you and Tim and Springs, you know, we were founding members of the Transnational Boxing Ratings Board. Talk about the decision to form the board and what goals you had in mind.
I mean, I think everybody's goals are different. Mine, I've always been kind of straightforward about, like, I wanted as best as possible to get a crew of people together so that we could take a look at the moments when, you know, when there isn't a clear world champion and you can sort of identify the new lineage that's emerging as best as possible so that fans can look at any given time and look at a place where, and this is big for all of us. We, you know, at the end of the day, if you're going to rank fighters 1 through 10, then 1 and 2 should mean something, right? So, we're a 1-2 organization when the titles are vacant, and we don't always come out with the same results everyone else does. So it doesn't always mean it's universal, or that we reflect any sort of, you know, universal like restart of a lineage or anything. But as best as possible, if there's a place where you can protect that lineage and you can just be sort of a standard that people can look to over a period of time, that was good enough for me. I don't care to make any money off of it. Not interested in sort of, you know, being a big promoter of it. I just wanted it to be sort of a rock thing that people could look at and say, hey, you know, week after week, they provide you their input into who they think the 10 best in each of boxing's 17 weight divisions are. And they give an honest take on it. And that's that.
Right, right. Well, you know, the membership has grown over the years, it seems, and it's definitely gotten more geographically diverse. Do you think it's you know, as representative as, say, you know, the sanctioning bodies now, where they have, you know, reps from major countries and, you know, major boxing countries and so on? Do you think TBRB has achieved that, or is that something you wanted to achieve, or how's that?
I think we've tried very hard to make sure that we have sort of a geographically diverse pool. I mean, it's hard, right? Like watch, even in this sort of more interconnected era where you can watch more fights than ever on, you know, YouTube, and where there's all these streaming services now as we head into the next decade, still, it's good to have people on the ground in places who are covering fights worldwide. Are we as representative as some of the sanctioning bodies? I don't know. I don't know enough about how they necessarily allocate for their ratings. But I think, you know, in a best case scenario, if you can get somebody to chime in on the ratings who is, you know, in Asia, you know, writing about Asian fighters, whether it's in Thailand or Japan, anything that you can get like that, you should aim for it. You know, it just widens the pool of knowledge that's available.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, since you're one of the writers whose scholarship on lineal champs and ratings I really respect, I wanted to talk to you about the art of rating fighters in 17 weight divisions. I mean, I had Steve Weisfeld on the podcast, and I talked to him about judging. So I wanted to talk to you about rating fighters. So let's say you're starting ratings from scratch. So how do you first go about, like, gathering fighters who are eligible to be rated in a top 10 of a particular division? I mean, do you just look at BoxRec? Do you look at the sanctioning ratings, the sanctioning bodies, their ratings, other publications like Ring, ESPN, Boxing Monthly? I mean, how do you kind of gather your pool of fighters in order to rate them?
I think that it was a lot of that at the very beginning. I mean, we pulled together, you know, what we... because once you had your first sort of draft of ratings, then it sort of took care of itself from there once you had a procedure set in place. So, but in this particular case, I mean, you pulled from the fighters that you knew of, like in a lot of weight divisions, starting at the very top, like who are the top two or three guys in each division? I mean, it was easy enough to compile that. Then you sort of work backwards, you know, look at the records, look who's been beating who lately. I'd have to go back to 2012 to sort of look at the notes to see everything that we did to compile the first list. But once we whittled it down to a draft, and then we had put together the inaugural board for TBRB, then the process was really about getting what the consensus of the board was going to be for the first ratings and then going from there.
Gotcha. So just you personally, I mean, once you have the pool of fighters, like what criteria do you have that goes into rating fighters, you know, one above the other? I mean, is it solely resume, or do you also go off the eye test and how they are winning fights? You know, does potential figure into the ratings, you know, common opponents? I mean, what all do you look at when you're comparing them?
In a perfect world, then you wouldn't need the eye test, right? Like everybody would be fighting everybody so frequently that you'd have a pretty good pool size to look at. It's not really like that. I mean, once you get past a certain level in the sport, even into the top 10. So not, you know, it used to be like in the last 40 years, we've seen champions slow down their schedule, but everybody else might fight a little bit more often than that. It's not like that anymore. So, you know, even regular fighters, like before they get to a title, they sort of slow down to maybe 3 to 4 fights a year, 2 to 3 sometimes right as they're hitting the title area. So really, I mean, once you're talking about rating fighters, you really want to be looking at results as much as possible. And then activity level also matters. So if you haven't fought in over a year, you know, does that matter? Do you have a fight signed? Or are you just sitting out waiting for a big payday? But really, who have you beaten? And then, like, who have you beaten in your last 5 or so fights, right? Because that can cover 2.5 years of a fighter's career. Right. And it's easy when you're getting to guys like Floyd Mayweather, right? Like, Floyd didn't lose ever. So it was always easy to kind of have him around the number one spot.
Right, right. But
sometimes you have to make other calls. But, I mean, think about welterweight right now. So how hard is it really to rate welterweight? You have two guys that everybody sort of thinks are the best guys in the division. So you got Errol Spence and you got Terrence Crawford. That's sort of the fight everybody would like to see. And when I say everybody, it's like that's a soft everybody. I mean, there's plenty of other fights people would like to see. But that's the big one in a lot of people's head right now. How do you figure out who to rate there, right? Well, you could take a look at top 10 welterweights. Who beat more of them? So, you know, Kell Brook has beaten he's beaten a couple guys who were rated. Terrence Crawford really hasn't in the division yet. He beat Jeff Horn, who was rated after the Pacquiao fight, but that was kind of a soft top 10 spot for Jeff Horn. A lot of people didn't think he won that fight. Errol Spence beat a guy in Kell Brook who had been rated, you know, in the upper echelon of the top 10, number one at some places for a couple of years. I mean, if you're picking between the two of them, you go with the guy who's sort of got the better wins at welterweight right now. But then what do you do if you got to weigh Keith Thurman against those two guys? Because Keith Thurman has wins against Sean Porter and Danny Garcia. So he's got maybe more quality wins in the division than a Crawford or a Spence. So where would you rate him? Especially considered he didn't fight for like a year and a half. So does that cost him his spot? Seems like most of the ratings that are out there, whether it's ours or ranks or anybody, they all seem to sort of have Keith Thurman slipping behind those guys. But ultimately, it doesn't matter because you know those are probably your top three. All three of those guys are in your top five at least. And ultimately, you would hope most of them will fight. At least on the PBC side, I think we'll see most of the fights that are available through that crew of guys.
Right, right, right. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, what does Crawford do and, you know, how does he keep pace? But, you know, obviously the whole, you know, at least the hardcores in the sport, most boxing fans in general, if you're a boxing fan, you want to see Spence Crawford. We're hoping that one eventually does happen.
Oh, yeah.
But you're right. Like, yeah, like
that. I remember, I think it was, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, weighing those three, it's a really interesting case, you know, because, you know, what do you weigh there? Resume, recent activity, you know, maybe, you know, potential ability, you know, what, you know, how do you rate those guys? Because they haven't fought each other.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as eye test goes, in a divisional race, you really shouldn't need too much eye test, right? Like, you should have enough resume that you can do that. Do I think people eyeball sometimes? Yeah. Do I think they always have, even in, you know, quote unquote independent ratings? Of course they have, right? Like sometimes you're trying to make a decision based on a smaller pool of evidence and you expect that evidence to grow. And that happens. And sometimes that's tough here. I mean, again, with lower activity fighters in a lower activity era, it can be hard to get the resume going. But I think you should save your eye test more for more stuff like pound for pound ratings. If you're going to employ it at all. But I think resume should always be the first thing that you're looking at in rating a fighter in a division.
Right. Now, you know, I used to go into the I think I at boxing scene, you used to have like when you did the divisional ratings there, you had like some comment section. I used to go in every once in a while and nitpick with you. But I noticed that you had most times you would have the title holders of each major sanctioning belt in your top 10. I mean, do you give more credence to the belt holders in the ratings if all else is equal in resume or if it's close?
It's hard, right? Like there's sort of an organic element to it. So when guys win belts, typically they win belts against somebody who is probably in or around the top 10 of the division anyway. So the belt doesn't necessarily generate the rating. The belt is lined up with a fight that would get you rated anyways. That's what I find to be the case most of the time. And I don't do my own ratings anymore like I used to at boxing team, but what I do is I try to keep track of, and I put this out, you know, four or five times a year now, a list of all the champions in the sport. So Ring, TBRB, all of the sanctioning body champions, how many defenses each of those champions has, and then what are the records that we can take a look at for each of the sanctioning body titles? So who has the most IBF, consecutive IBF heavyweight title defenses? That's Vladimir Klitschko, by the way. And then, you know, the history, and then history's overall records. So that way you have a place where you can sort of separate. I wrote an article before one of the Golovkin-Alvarez fights. And basically I was talking about who is the record holder for consecutive title defenses in middleweight. Because it's really that you could come up with more than one answer for that.
Right.
Fighters, people who have been watching in the last 20 years might just answer Bernard Hopkins on Reflex. But Bernard was the IBF champion for 20 defenses, but he wasn't undisputed until he was around his 14th title defense. Whereas Carlos Monzon won the undisputed title and defended it straight through 14 times. So those are two different records, really, when you're talking about it. So finding a way to let people know that there's a difference between some of these records, and I'm not saying one is better than the other or anything like that. People can make their mind up about that themselves. But if you can just present them the numbers, then they can make an informed decision.
Right.
An informed opinion.
Right. So I mean, it's very difficult and just with fights, 17 weight divisions, fights going on all over the world. I mean, how often do you check like BoxRec or update your ratings, like daily, weekly? I mean, how often does that happen?
I mean, we do TBRB updates every week. So, we all, but we've got a formal structure for it now. So everybody recognizes, right? You don't want to have a single point of failure. And so what we do is we have two guys that monitor the results from the weekend for rated fighters. So, and any other notable results that they want to include in the mix. And so one guy takes like from welterweight up and the other guy takes from welterweight down, and they make sure everybody has the results before we start talking about, okay, here's what we'd like to see, moving in the ratings this week. So, and typically I might start the conversation and say, okay, I suggest, we move fighter X to here and whatever it is. And then I'll send that email around and it goes to the crew and, of guys that take the first look, first pass each week. And then, we go to the board, the full board and we say, here's what we think. And then we debate it out.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What's the process of voting and tabulating the monthly ratings? I mean, is it a point system? I mean, do you take a day or two to debate? I mean, how does that work?
No, so basically it's just like that. So we'll start a conversation. Hey, this last weekend, Devin Haney had a real impressive showing. Should Devin Haney, who we had rated 10th at lightweight, should we move him up a slot or two? That's a debate that's going on right now. So we might make a suggestion about where he should go in the ratings. And then, we post to an internal message board and everybody kind of can go in there and talk about it. And, basically it's just a debate. It's not, you tally the votes at the end for everybody that weighed in. And you're not required to weigh in. I mean, sometimes guys just might agree with the suggestion and not have something to say that week. But, people debate about it and whatever the outcome is democratic. If everybody's like, no, hell no, we don't move that fighter up, then that wins. And, it's just a way to start the conversation each week, keep it orderly. And usually we take about 3 days and then we post the week's new ratings.
I got you. It's interesting, too, when you have, I remember being on a ratings poll in the early 2000s. And the one thing that was really annoying was that you'd have certain fighters who, different voters would rate him in different divisions. And so it would be like he'd get like a watered down rating in two divisions as opposed to like a strong one in one. What happens when you have a fighter like Mikey Garcia, who's like constantly jumping around divisions? I mean, do you have a mechanism where you pin him down to one division, or do you let the membership decide where they want to put him in? I mean, can he be rated in more than one division?
We have no problem rating a guy in more than one division. I mean, it may be a case where they're just jumping around a lot. With Mikey, he's still rated, I believe, at lightweight for us. I'd have to check and pull it up. But I mean, if let's say you've got a champion, right? So Mikey Garcia, when he beat when he fought at Sergey Lipinets. So that was a 1-2 fight for TBRB. So the winner was our junior welterweight champion. So Mikey Garcia is still listed as the junior welterweight champion at TBRB. So, but it doesn't look like, at least to my eyes, that he's going to fight at junior welterweight soon again, if at all. So, what you do in that case is you try to reach out to their camp and ask, are you intending to fight at junior welterweight again? Because we're not going to strip guys of our recognition outside of the ring unless, there's circumstances where you could remove somebody's championship designation. But, you want to go through the process, and we have that all in the charter. So, but I mean, that's what we do. You just reach out, you know, are you still fighting in this division? But if you're the best lightweight in the world and the best junior welterweight in the world, and you're fighting in both divisions on a regular basis, then why not be rated in both divisions?
Right, right. Well, that's interesting. And I guess you kind of touched on it a little bit before, but you know, you said that, you know, the number one and two fought, and I would assume that junior welterweight didn't have a lineal champion at the time. So if the TBRB crowns a champion, you know, do you consider that, like, Garcia a lineal champion now of junior welterweight?
So me personally, this is one of those funny things. You know, and again, it gets into sort of that whole weird, like, what is lineage, and when do you know you've seen it? And what I look for when I'm going to record it, and it I'm far from the authority on this. You know, I'm just one person weighing in on, you know, when I think you should maybe record someone as a new historical champion. But I think when there's a legit consensus that builds around one particular guy, in the absence of an existing lineage, then you would go in that direction. Like right now, you know, it's easy at cruiserweight, right? Like he has all Oleksandr Usyk had all the belts. He beat the number two guy. So, you know, in that case, of course I recognize him as lineal, but so would anyone else, right? Like he's not going to stay in the division, but he's an easy example. In a case like Mikey and Lippin yet, we might not come out to the same result that somebody else might. An example would be, you know, Ring recognized the winner of Jorge Linares and Anthony Crolla as the lightweight champion. We didn't. Okay. But if somebody wanted to view that as the lineal crown, they could, from the ring side. But I think in those kind of cases where it's not a 100% consensus, you might want to wait a little bit longer. But TBRB is still giving our point of view on a good jumping off point on where we thought we saw a good one versus two matchup.
Right, right, right. So, you know, for, you know, just for like, you know, lineal purposes, I mean, I remember there was the big debate when it was Mikulchevsky and Jones, where Jones had three of the four belts, but Mikulchevsky had kind of, you know, won it. But even Mikulchevsky, I mean, I don't think there was ever like a four belt champion, or, I mean, he won because Virgil Hill had unified, right, with Henry Mask. And then he beat.
That was an easy one though, right? So go back, and if you look at the sequence of events that happened there, that's a pretty easy one to come out with a lineage. So you didn't have a clear lineage at the time. But when Virgil Hill fought Henry Mask, you could say that was the consensus one and two fighters in the division, okay? And Roy wasn't really a factor at light heavyweight yet. He was still fighting at super middleweight. I can't remember. He may have just moved up to fight Mike McCallum, but he wasn't a real factor in the division yet. The other champion in the division at the time was Fabrice Chiozzo. Chiozzo had beaten Mike McCallum for his belt, and before he won that belt, the WBA belt, Chiozzo had lost in a title defense, Chiozzo, I think, had the WBC belt. Virgil Hill had the WBA because it was his second reign where he made 10 title defenses in each of his two reigns. So in his second reign, he had successfully defended against Chiozzo before Chiozzo wins the other sanctioning body belt, and then Henry Mask was just racking up defenses on the other side. So by the time Hill and Mask square off, by process of elimination in the division, the top two light heavyweights in the world were Hill and Mask. Who beat Virgil Hill? Darius Mikulchevsky.
Right.
So that's your lineage. And then it doesn't matter anymore. Like, do I think Roy Jones Jr. was better than Darius Mikulchevsky? Oh, hell yeah. I mean, and I think it, you know, I mean, in terms of overall career, in terms of light heavyweight and who beat better fighters, who had a greater depth of challenges on their resume, I think that would go to Roy's advantage. That's just my opinion. But in terms of lineage, it's not really, I never understood why it was much of a debate. I mean, Mikulchevsky beat Hill, and Hill earned that recognition in the ring.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I guess, you know, it became a debate because those two just never fought, and, you know, Roy had three belts, and then it just seemed
like... Roy was perceptually, I'm not, we never saw him in the ring, so you'll never know for sure, but Roy was perceptually so much better than Darius Mikulchevsky.
Right, right, exactly.
For a lot of people, the real answer to the question for them was, who gives a damn about the lineage? Like, Roy Jones is the best light heavyweight in the world, and that's what mattered to them. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that line of thinking. But I mean, if you're going to keep track of lines and stuff and lineages and you want to see people do it in the ring first, then you would still want to pay attention to something like Hill to Mikuljevski.
Right, right. No doubt. So I guess, you know, thinking about the TBRB and what influence it's had, I mean, have you been satisfied with the traction and influence that TBRB has gotten in the boxing world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much we have. I mean, it's hard to gauge that sort of thing. I mean, every once in a while you'll hear somebody give us a good shout out. There's lots of people that you'll read in sort of some of the press areas that will, you know, take a look at where we have fighters ranked. That's good enough for me. I never felt like personally that it was super important that everybody glom onto us right away. I think what is important is after 7 years, we're still there. We're still doing this every week. You've still got a bunch of people who love boxing, who get together, you know, get that meeting of the minds going to discuss like where fighter X and Y should go. And we provide that to the public. I think we do a good job with it, and we're consistent. And, you know, if people can use that to help them figure out what they think or give them a good idea of who the best fighters in each division are, then I think we've done more than enough.
Yeah, listen, I think there's tremendous value to having an independent poll, especially with, you know, the sanctioning bodies not exactly, you know, doing the job that they're meant to do, which is rate fighters and rate the best in the world. So the best fight the best. And I think, you know, you guys have definitely one of the best set of independent ratings and just processes going. Have any of the sanctioning bodies reached out to you to adopt your ratings? I mean, I remember back in the early 2000s when the WBA had some controversy with their ratings. I remember they were talking to like Charles Jay about having some sort of independent ratings board come and do their ratings. But I don't know, they could never work something like that out. I mean, would you guys even be amenable to that?
No, it hasn't been anything that has been brought up to me. I don't want to get into a business relationship with anybody over the ratings or anything personally. So that hasn't been anything that's really come up for us. No,
I gotcha. Yeah, I wrote an article last year on my concept of what a boxing league, you know, could be and how it could take shape. And my idea was to have the sport adopt, you know, like the World Boxing Super Series type tourneys in each division. You know, you do tourneys, you know, five or six divisions a year and rotate them. And I proposed that the league use the TBRB or some hybrid of like TBRB and BoxRec or maybe Boxing Monthly to come up with the final ratings to determine seedings for the tourneys. So like if the World Boxing Super Series, which I think is kind of like the model for the sport right now, if they reached out to you guys to use your ratings to determine seedings in their tourneys, would you guys be like amenable to that?
Sure. I mean, there's nothing stopping them from doing it right now.
Right. I agree. I mean, I wish they would.
They're out there. They're in public, right? We're not looking for a branding opportunity. If you want to take our ratings and say these are where we're seating people based on where they are in the TBRB ratings, you go right ahead. We'd love that. You know?
Right. I mean, I think it would give them a lot. You know, not that they don't have, I mean, they have tremendous credibility because they're doing something in the sport that's just not happening otherwise. But I think, you know, if a few of the choices they've made for entrance in the tournament, I was just kind of like, that guy's not even in the top 25, man. You know, like.
But here's the thing, right? Here's the thing. And I'm a big, I love the World Boxing Super Series. I have been a big fan of what they've done. I mean, the least sort of aggressive of the tournaments, I guess, on paper was the super middleweight one. Aggressive is just the word I'm using there in terms of the depth that they were able to give the tournament. And again, it's ability, right? Like you have to have the ability to get all of these fighters that you want. But I mean, if you look at the current cruiserweight tournament, the part two cruiserweight tournament, I think going in, five of the eight competitors were rated in the top 10 by TBRB, and ring. If you look at the bantamweight tournament before Tete fell out, going into the tournament, you had three of the top four fighters in the division, not including Luis Neri, who had some other issues going on outside the ring for a while, and now he's signed somewhere else. But you had a big chunk of the bantamweight top 10. You're ultimately going to have probably the consensus 1-2 fighters in the division when Pregrai fights Josh Taylor. the first cruiserweight tournament was stacked top to bottom with top 10 guys. I mean, I'll take it if, you know, a couple of the guys in the quarterfinals maybe shouldn't be there because you have to fill out the brackets. And you can't, there's just, boxing is a little too convoluted globally to get the top 8 fighters in anybody's ratings in one place at one time. But if you can get 5 and get into a semifinal where all, you know, the cruiserweight, the first cruiserweight tournament had the entire championship roster at cruiserweight. I mean, I'll live with a bad quarterfinal round if we get all 4 belts unified at the end.
Right, right. Absolutely. I just wish as a baseline they'd use like the TBRB just to, you know, to at the very least reach out to guys in the top 10 there. So, you know, they can, you know, see if they can get as many as they can. Because otherwise, you know, it, if it gets a little too arbitrary, then it's no better than the sanctioning bodies. But even so, yeah, there's, I mean, I'm a massive, massive, massive fan of the World Boxing Super Series. I hope they survive beyond this year. So
I do too. I think it's great. And I mean, look, you look at bantamweight right now, they got all that talent there. I mean, the possibilities in the right divisions. I mean, you're not going to probably be able to pull off a World Boxing Super Series in middleweight or welterweight. Or heavyweight, right? Those are glamour divisions, and they process differently. And often you don't need a World Boxing Super Series there. I mean, there aren't very many generations where welterweight doesn't shake out and provide the matchups that you're looking for. I mean, Pacquiao and Mayweather, you know, I think the long wait for that got in a lot of people's heads in terms of viewers and fans and pundits. But for the most part, that's not how it works, right? Like, the generational fights tend to happen at middleweight and welterweight. The divisions where you haven't seen that enough are divisions like bantamweight, where, you know, we went a generation, I think, almost without a unification fight at bantamweight. Flyweight didn't have a unification fight for almost 40 years until Brian Valoria fought Tyson Marquez back in 2012.
Mm.
Things like the World Boxing Super Series give an opportunity for those type of divisions to have some real action. To give some clarity to the generation and to give you an idea of who the best fighters in those times are. To think about how many fights we didn't get to see at bantamweight over the years. I mean, we never saw Timmy Austin or Rafael Marquez fight Birapulse Habrom or Hozumi Hasegawa or any of those kind of fights. I mean, we got a small window of that when Montiel and Donaire and some of those guys fought each other. But that was like the first time in, what, 20, 30 years where you'd seen a real clarity in that division. And World Boxing Super Series allows for that to happen in some divisions that don't always get it. So that's great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I was actually bugging Russell Peltz on when I had him on about not making Jeff Chandler and Lupe Pintor, because that would have been like an amazing fight.
Oh, my God, that would have been a good fight. Yeah, I mean, Jeff, and again, I mean, think about it. Like, Jeff Chandler had a great career, but it's a crying shame that Jeff Chandler never got a chance to unify the division. You know, it's just, it's one of those things that, you know, in terms of, especially back in his day, he only had 2 guys, right?
You
didn't have the IBA around yet. It would have just been cool. And any unification you can see in divisions where you don't see a lot of it, I'm all for, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, even the cruiserweights, you know, just having, I mean, that hadn't really been done. I mean, there had been a couple, like, you know, like one or two belts would be, or, you know, obviously 2 belts would be unified. But yeah, there hadn't been like an undisputed since Holyfield. So that was great.
No, well, not quite. You actually, we had a pretty good pocket in the previous decade. Remember, we had O'Neill Bell and Mormet was a 3 belt fight. And then one of the belts got stripped, I think, off of Mormec after the rematch. And then he fought Hay, and Hay had 2. And then Hay added the WBO. So you did have that quick cluster of it, but
right,
it was over
right.
quick.
Right, right. Oh, I totally forgot about that. That's right. Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. So, hey, let's talk about...
Yeah, Cruiserweight's been lucky in that regard. So, you know, it's lined up a few more times than some of the other divisions that you might expect. So...
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny because there were some complaints that, you know, why would they do the cruiserweights back-to-back, the World Boxing Super Series? But in fact, I mean, you've got both Gassiev and Usyk moving up, so I'm not going to be mad, you know, at the winner of the tournament. I would definitely call him the number one cruiserweight in the world, you know? You've got
that. Yeah, I think it lined up perfect for that. And the thing is with cruiserweight, especially in the 21st century, it's been one of the most consistent action classes in boxing. So if you're looking to put on good action fights that are competitive, where you don't always know the outcome, cruiserweight is a pretty good location for that. And it's chock full of lots of guys who are super experienced at the amateur level. I mean, there's just a lot of talent there. And it's just talent that, doesn't necessarily have that sort of size and extra bit of athleticism to compete with some of these monsters that are in the heavyweight division right now. I mean, the heavyweight division, it got big in the 90s, and it has stayed big for quite a while.
That's true. It's true. Yeah. I mean, let's hope that they don't create any more divisions. But yeah, it is definitely a big leap from cruiserweight to heavyweight these
days.
Oh,
God, no. Uh-uh. I mean, if you cruiserweight is fine right where it is. I mean, that's an incredible jump. I mean, it used to be that going light heavyweight to heavyweight was the jump, right? But that was going 175 pounds up to maybe, you know, maxing out at outside of a like a Willard or a Carnera, who was an aberration in their time. You were going up to fight Lewis, who was 200 pounds, or a Liston that was 210, 215. 175 to Anthony Joshua, that's a big jump. That's almost like taking Noya Inoue and having him go up and fight a light heavyweight.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, that's how big the jump in size and weight is. And I know that there's some differences that you'll talk to trainers and they'll talk about coordination and footwork and fluidity and athletic fluidity past a certain size. But still, like, when you're going from light heavyweight to heavyweight now, you're talking about a jump of almost 75 pounds. Versus, you know, just going to cruiserweight is sort of the jump it used to be. You're going from 75 to 200. Those cruiserweights then go unlimited. I think having the unlimited class be at 200 pounds and stay there is fine with me. I mean, you still have guys like Hay, like Deontay Wilder has won fights at 210, 212. I mean, I think the weight line is where it should be, and they shouldn't mess with heavyweight. Heavyweight is, I don't think we need to mess with it any more than it already has been.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So listen, let's talk about the state of the game right now. I mean, it's, you know, it's late May 2019. I mean, we've got more money in the sport and more fights broadcast in the States and around the world than, you know, any time in the sport's history. This year in particular, though, I've been a little disappointed that we're getting kind of a lot of, you know, I mean, there's been some good fights, but there's also been just a lot of kind of meaningless in-house fights between, you know, the folks that are on the networks. I mean, how would you rate 2019 so far in terms of delivering the goods to the fans?
Off to a slow start. It's getting better, but it got off to a slow start. I mean, but how could it not? Last year, I mean, think about what we got in the last third. Let's say the last third of 2018. So DAZN launched, and so you got a bunch of those World Boxing Super Series fights. You got Usyk and Tony Bellew, which felt like a big event. You got Joshua and Povetkin, you got Canelo's debut, even though it was against a guy, you know, who he was not going to lose to. It was still an event because it's Canelo at the Garden, right? So you had all of that going on. You had Fury and Wilder on Showtime, which was really just compelling stuff and well-built. And they had a pretty strong last third of the year. ESPN debuts, they get into the game. All of that was, like, the top-ranked deal happened last year. You had the end of HBO Boxing. You have Canelo and Golovkin too. So there was all of that in the last 4 months of 2018. That's a hard act to follow in the next 4 months after that.
Right.
So we've had some really good fights. Jarrett Hurd and Julian Williams was just a gem. What a great show they put on. Last weekend, you got the Jermell Herring fight. Great story. You've had some good action fights in multiple divisions. But May, I think April, May, we've really seen sort of the year get better. So if you're a hardcore fan, you had Gaio Estrada in the rematch with Teresa Kitsarungbisai. You've had the World Boxing Super Series stuff. If you're, you know, just a general fan of boxing, you had Canelo and Jacobs, which I thought, you know, a lot of people didn't like that fight. I thought it was pretty good. So I was fine with that. You had Deontay Wilder with another, you know, highlight reel knockout. I mean, punchers like him don't come along every day. So you just enjoy it when he's in the ring. I think things have gotten better. We've had a couple busy weeks. You know, Joshua's coming to the Garden in a couple weeks.
Right.
So it's getting better, but I mean, it's hard, you know, boxing is always struggled in this era of, I don't mean this era. It's really going on two generations now when you think about it, Kurt. So you have this sort of split programming stuff that goes on, and then it's hard to keep the consistency. I mean, you know, people talk about how Top Rank and Don King used to do business back in the 80s when the fights were really big. Sure, they did some really big fights, but how often did they really do business? And how often was it better business to just leave, you know, each side with the champions that they had fighting the guys that that were most available? And you would have like a outfit like Main Event would kind of float back and forth between because they had a stable that could do business with lots of people. So, you know, they would take Pernell Whitaker over to fight Julio Cesar Chavez or find ways to get Evander in the ring with Mike Tyson. And that would bring the networks together. They tried to do Holyfield and Tyson in 91. And then, you know, that wound up happening all in-house for Don later on, but they were trying. It's just gotten harder. And now you've got three distinct networks, and some very distinct, you know, sort of teams of people and fights. And it's, you know, consistency is going to be tough.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, obviously I wish that, that these guys would just kind of wise up like the, you know, owners of the barnstorming football teams did in the '20s and decide, hey, why don't we all just work together, form a schedule in the league and, you know, and consolidate instead of competing with each other and trying to put each other out of business and all this. And geez, the NFL's done pretty well since then. But, I guess, yeah. As far as your view on, let's take the heavyweights. I mean, do you think it's a mistake that Wilder and Joshua seem to be kind of unwilling to make the biggest fight at heavyweight happen so far? I mean, and when do you see that fight happening realistically?
I said last year, I thought that we had arrived at, I was okay with waiting a little bit. You know, when you get something that becomes a fight, you know, a little weight doesn't hurt, right? I understand these guys are, you know, they're risking their lives, you know, trying to generate that big purse. It's fine, you know. And I mean, Tommy Hearns and Ray Leonard was the fight right after the No Mas fight. And yet they still took some interim fights and let that get built up to let the public get their breath, you know, you sort of build up their anticipation for the next big event, right? It all still happened within a year. The problem now is you build that anticipation, it can build up for years. And then the likelihood that you're going to get more than one fight out of a rivalry goes down. So you don't have as many epic series among the very top fighters. Like you might get a Barrera Morales where the rivalry started at junior featherweight and was very hardcore centric, but at its genesis. But you know, you only got one Mayweather Pacquiao. We're likely only going to see guys like Joshua Wilder once. I mean, Deontay Wilder is already 33 years old.
Right.
We're not, you know, I mean, I know we've gotten used to seeing some heavyweights go till they're 39 or 40, but that's not common all time. And I don't think it's going to be common here either. I mean, I don't think all these guys are going to be, you know, racking up big wins still when they're 40. It just doesn't work that way.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, listen, I mean, my thought on it is, yeah, I mean, they're in their primes right now and they really kind of need to hurry and get you know, a few big money fights in because, yeah, you're right. I mean, Lewis Bowe never got made because they got too cute with it. And then, you know, one guy would lose and this and that. And also you got the Olympic class of 2016 coming up. And I mean, these guys are going to be coming of age, you know, late 2020, you know, mid 2021. So they need to hurry
and fight each other. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm a pretty optimistic guy, but yeah, I mean, from just a viewing perspective, it sucks. Nobody wants to see these fights not happen. We'd like to see them happen more than once. That said, we did just see Wilder and Fury. I mean, it was less than 6 months ago. So, you know, it's not like we haven't seen any of these fights. So we saw Fury and Joshua fight Klitschko. We have seen Wilder just last year fight Luis Ortiz and Tyson Fury. I think what should be reasonable in the next few years, right? This is in my head, is fans should expect to see one combination of those three guys per year until that rotation has worn itself out. I mean, at the very least, you should be able to see that. And I think that's what could be ultimately very disappointing about 2019 is I don't think we're likely to see any combination of Fury, Joshua, and Wilder. I hope I'm wrong. It just doesn't look like we're going that way. And so that would be disappointing. But as far as, you know, I mean, do I think it's terrible that they're not fighting right now? Yes. But, you know, at the very least, we should hope to see one combination of the three this year, and we're not going to likely. So.
Yeah, that's a damn shame. Yeah, I mean, I just seems to me, you know, it would make so much sense for the fall for Joshua Wilder to happen. But, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, they say it's a possibility, well, but then you also see that Wilder may have a lot of – future fights worked out.
Oh, yeah, and it says a lot about the styles right now, about what fans like to see, because Tyson Fury, most people thought that he deserved the decision against Deontay Wilder. But right. The fight that I think the most number of people still want to see, at least in the United States, is Wilder and Joshua because of the knockout threat that both fighters pose to each other. As entertaining as Fury is, he's not somebody that you're worried about is going to knock people senseless all the time. Joshua and Wilder has that sort of, almost action movie dynamic to it that we're going to want to all see come together at some point. I just hope it happens while they're both still reasonably near their prime.
Right. Yeah, I hope it doesn't turn into Bo Lewis or Lou. You know, it's got to happen. I hope one guy doesn't get upset before it does happen. That would just really take the air out of it.
Here's the other thing. Here's the other thing I think fans can keep in mind. So if you're getting frustrated that you're not seeing the fight that you want at heavyweight, fans should pay attention to where the clusters are in boxing right now. So boxing, the way it's set up with the DAZN sort of lane and the PBC lane and the top ranked ESPN lane, pay attention to who has big real estate and in what divisions. You saw a couple weeks ago, ESPN started talking about what could be possible for them to do at light heavyweight. And they should, because they have a huge chunk of that division. And so that can be their quality control. So they can put on some main events that people aren't crazy about, but light heavyweight can be that source of quality for them. DAZN has these World Boxing Super Series tournaments. PBC has welterweight and junior middleweight. If fans are paying attention, they'll know where they can find the best possible action available in 2019, 2020, 2021, based on who has what and how much of certain divisions. And that's where boxing will be at its best in the coming years. And then at a place like heavyweight, you'll have a lot of finger crossing and teeth gnashing and, three very distinct tracks until one of those guys loses or some belts start moving around.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing, Steven Espinoza talking about it, and kind of the goal of the networks was to try and, kind of get a monopoly on not a monopoly in a legal sense, but just kind of corner the market on a weight division so that you have the stars in that division and also opponents for them. So, yeah, that's a really salient point about, PBC definitely has, great fighters at welterweight and junior middleweight. And, it'd be nice if they did like a real tourney, instead of just kind of, you get the fights when you get the fights. It'd be nice if you could follow along in a bracket. To me, that works better, but it doesn't seem like anyone's going to do that. But yeah, top rank at light heavyweight would be tremendous. Like, I guess, that's a question too. If in a perfect world, what division would you like to see a World Boxing Super Series tournament in? Like, what would be your number one division that you want to see it in?
Ooh, right now?
Yeah.
That's a tough call. if you could have it anywhere, you probably want to see it at welterweight right now, because that would put ultimately give the opportunity for Crawford and Spencer, or Crawford and Thurman, or Spence and Thurman. It would tell us who the best welterweight in the world is. And I think that's an intriguing question right now, because really you've got a big chunk of the division on one side, and then you've got Terrence Crawford over here. So it's sort of a one against the world kind of. It would be a fascinating tournament. So you could do something with that. That'd be fun. Middleweight, I think you're getting it anyways. I think you're going to get I like brackets too. Don't get me wrong. I love the structure of the Super Six, even though it didn't always play out. I love the structure of the WBSS. However, if you can get a good enough round robin together, you don't need that structure, right? Like, nobody remembers that. It doesn't matter that Ray Leonard and Tommy Hearns and Wilfred Benitez and Marvin Hagler didn't fight in a bracket, because outside of Benitez Hagler, you saw all of those fights, and you saw some of them more than once. So you didn't need a tournament. You had a round robin. And as long as you get those round robins going in places, it's good. But if I could put structure somewhere, welterweight and junior middleweight are two classes. Junior bantamweight is still one I'd love to see. The depth is fantastic. And I think we're seeing it at bantamweight. I'd love to see it finish playing out. When Tete fell out of the World Boxing Super Series at bantamweight, it created an opportunity for Inoue to still have, or Daenerys, whoever wins the tournament, to still have guys like Luis Neri and Zolani Tete out there. So there's still real fights out there. So I'd like to see sort of, an epilogue to the tournament that includes the fighters that weren't involved in the first place. Sort of like we got at Cruiserweight when Usyk fought Belu.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're someone who obviously tracks ratings and divisions. I mean, you know, which divisions would you say are kind of overlooked right now that the people aren't really tracking, or that you'd like to see like more big fights in?
I don't know if anything's really overlooked right now, to be honest. In 2019, I'll be honest with you, in 2019, boxing is, because so much content is available, if you are interested in seeing the best fighters in the world at lighter weight classes, so like I grew up watching Michael Carvajal, and so I got interested in flyweight level, in flyweight size fighters. But, you know, if that interests you, then you can find that out there right now. And so it's not overlooked by people who are interested. But there are people out there who will never be super interested in watching 115-pound fighters. It just does not appeal to them on an aesthetic level, on some sort of a – there's almost like a mental block in it when they're watching it. So be it. Because then middleweight is out there and welterweight. And sometimes I think, you know, in between, junior middleweight, a lot of what's going on there can still get overlooked. Cruiserweight that still doesn't always get the respect it deserves in the United States, the big property elsewhere. So, I mean, I think what's overlooked depends on where you're viewing the sport from.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. This weekend, you know, we had, you know, a lot of fights, you know, on three networks, like a lot of fights. But then, you know, the one that, I mean, the fight that I was kind of the most interested in was the junior flyweight fight that
yeah,
ended up being
Connor
streamed.
So was I.
Yeah, and Kimura, mean, yeah.
Gonzalez and Sho Kimura looked great on paper, especially if you saw Tanaka and Kimura last year.
Absolutely.
Which was just,
that was my fight of the year.
Fantastic. Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, look, one thing I'll say about the smaller weight classes right now, and you know, there are people who know. I try to treat them the same way you would treat any other weight class. So, but I can't hide my enthusiasm sometimes because of the action level that you get. It is easier in recent years for fighters in those weight classes to prove the sort of historical greatness that fans, that some older fans and some established fans feel like you can't really get anymore because you don't have the frequency of difficult matchmaking, right?
Right.
In those weight classes, you're still seeing guys fight regularly against the top guys. I mean, if your complaint is that the best don't fight the best, then go look at what's been happening at flyweight and junior bantamweight and bantamweight, and not just this decade. I mean, 115 pounds was hot in the previous decade when you had fights like Maharez and D'Artagnan and Donaire made his name. And then you had, you know, that cluster of guys at bantamweight. You don't always get the very best matchup, just like you don't in any other weight class. But you've seen a lot of clash in those weight divisions that sometimes has been missing other places. So, you know, it's out there for you.
Right. Yeah, I guess, you know, I would love to see, you know, if the World Boxing Super Series continues, I'd love to see them grab the junior flyweights just because I love watching Canizales. That kid can fight. And you've got Shiro and Kayaguchi and Acosta in that division, too. You know,
that
just so many.
That kid can fight the Dickens, man. He really can crack.
Absolutely. Just so many great fights here I could see happening in that division. So, well, I guess, let's see. If you could have your druthers, though, what five fights would you love to see happen in boxing right now? What are the five fights that you're hoping get made? Or maybe they've already been made. But what are your, like, five fights that you would love to see made in the sport?
All right. So if I was king for a day, the fights that I would probably most want to see are, I would like to see Noya Inoue fight Luis Neri at
Absolutely.
Yep. I would love to see that fight. I would love to see Oscar Valdez versus Leo Santa Cruz at featherweight. I think that
fight
would be just sensational. I would love to see, and I might be the only one, but based on recent form, I think Miguel Burchell and Vasyl Lomachenko would be a really interesting fight. So I would be interested in that. And I'm talking about fights that aren't made because Pagrai Taylor is as good a fight as I think you can
yes,
make in the sport. Yes,
absolutely.
That.
Love that fight. Absolutely love it.
Love that fight. What else? I think I would really like to see the Spence Crawford is up there. And I would be fascinated in seeing, if we go that direction, a Canelo Alvarez versus Callum Smith fight. I think that would be one hell of a scrap.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
And it seems very possible too. It seems like it's mm-hmm. something that's been talked about. I want to see Joshua Wilder, just I think for the sport, I think that one needs to happen. But I'm just as intrigued if that doesn't get made and Usyk is you know proves to, that the heavyweight's not too big for him. That is one hell of an interesting fight, Joshua Usyk. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know that Joshua wins that fight.
I'll tell you which one I would be even more interested. I actually have, and I've tweeted this before. I would love to see Usyk fight Deontay Wilder. I think that clash of styles would be absolutely fascinating. And I'll tell you one more. I'm cheating now. I'm going over five. But at middleweight, if Canelo finishes pulling all the belts together at middleweight, which he might, or at least three out of four, and holding those for a little while, eventually Jamal Charlo is going to be his mandatory.
Right.
And if he takes that mandatory, a Jamal Charlo, Canelo Alvarez fight is not only a great fight in the ring, but it's a great fight behind the scenes because it's a fight for the control of the middleweight division and which faction sort of gets to take the lead at middleweight. That sort of stuff, you know, for the fans out there that like to, you know, get into the business side of things and sort of the fascinating chess that can go on behind the scenes, I think that fight would be fascinating on so many different levels. But in particular, because I think it'd be a great fight in the ring.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Charlo's kind of the guy who's, you know, playing Frisbee by himself over in the PBC right now because all the middleweights are on the zone. But yeah, eventually Canelo's got to fight him. You know, he is the mandatory and it's just they got to step on the WBC because the WBC is notorious for not enforcing those mandatories in a timely fashion. So. so they definitely got to step on him. But yeah, I mean, I guess yeah, I don't know that this fight will ever get made. But to me, I mean, I'm looking at, you know, Devin Haney and Teofimo Lopez kind of on a collision course as well. But I don't know how long Lopez can stay at 35. But oh, man, that would be a great fight if it happened.
Haney's not good. I doubt Haney will be at 135 long. That fight, I think people who are already thinking about that as a potential future destination for the sport can go ahead and keep thinking about it because I mean I was there at the MGM on Saturday. I talked to Devin after the fight briefly and I asked him about making 135 and he noted it is tough and his body's growing. He's a 20-year-old kid making 135 and there isn't much room for body fat there.
Right.
So I would imagine he and Lopez will both be heading up the scale sooner than later.
No doubt. Well, that's a great fight at 140 too.
You know, I mean, yeah.
Either way, well, man, I'll take it.
Just, you know, some fights really do need a little marinade. That one's one of those that you can see it percolating right now, and you know, you let that steak cook long enough, you're gonna get a good one.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Teofimo seems like they both seem like they're in quite a bit of hurry. So yeah, well, it's gonna be interesting to see how the next year plays out with those guys. So I guess last question.
Well, and think about it too. It only feels like Devin Haney is fast tracking, right? Because he's 20. But there was a time in the sport not that long ago where a 20-year-old kid, it wasn't a fast track. If you were ready to fight for a world title at 20 or 21, going for one, I mean, usually you got a little farther into your 20s. But, you know, 20 years old wasn't too young to be a contender in another era. And it's still not. It's just that the way brand building happens in boxing kind of can slow the process down a little bit. But when you've got the goods, like a Floyd Mayweather, you know, you run them when they're ready to run.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, Haney looks like he's just about there, for sure. Yeah. So just in the month of June, I don't know if you've looked over the fight schedule at all, but, I mean, any big fights here or even smaller fights that you're looking forward to seeing in the month of June?
I think right now I'm just most interested in seeing, you know, what kind of reception Anthony Joshua gets at Madison Square Garden. You know, as big a star as he is in the UK, that star has not crossed the sea yet. He can stay home and be a multimillionaire for a long time. But if he wants, you know, part of being heavyweight champion of the world is conquering the globe. And that's a peculiar position. And we'll see if he can start to develop it. I don't see why he couldn't. But I mean, it's not easy all the time to build outside of your home market, but I think he travels well, and I think that's going to help really a lot. I think when you look at what guys like Ricky Hatton and Joe Calzaghe have done in the last 10, 15 years in terms of bringing fans across the pond and helping to provide more to an event atmosphere, you know, this is the beginning of the next phase of one of the biggest ticket draws we've seen in boxing in a long time, and I want to see how that evolves.
Absolutely. And those, you know, Calzaghe and Hatton, they were selling out, you know, you know, fairly big venues, but they weren't selling out Wembley. So, and I've heard it's close to a sellout at the Garden, but not quite. So I think there may be a thousand or so short of a sellout, but I think it's going to be rocking.
But it's a start. Remember when Hatton came over to Vegas to fight Castillo, it wasn't what it was for Mayweather, but it got the ball rolling. So, right. You know, can it get that ball rolling? Because it's clear at this point, we're not going to get Wilder Joshua until it is fever pitch and the biggest possible event it can be. And part of building that event is making Joshua more attractive as a pay-per-view, as a pay-per-view draw in the United States. Because let's be honest, right now, that is not as big a pay-per-view fight as it could be. And so, you know, it just isn't, because Joshua doesn't have the sort of name recognition in the U.S. yet that he will after a few more fights as he starts to travel.
Absolutely. I'm going to ask you about a couple of fights. One on that undercard that I think is really interesting. There's a couple of fights on that undercard, the Joshua Ruiz undercard that I thought were interesting. But Josh Kelly stepping up to take on Ray Robinson. What do you think about that fight?
I like it. I mean, Robinson's the kind of guy who can give anybody a good test. His last fight out, he gave a good test. So, those are the kind of fights that you have to develop with. And it's also, it's good quality control for an undercard, right? Like, you want to have fights where, you know, you can develop a new name, but also get them real rounds so that you're finding out more about them as you move along and putting them in situations where they could potentially lose. And Robinson's the kind of fighter who could sneak up on somebody.
Absolutely. That is a tremendous test for Kelly. I don't even think Kelly has 10 fights at this point in time. So, you know, Robinson obviously had the draw with Mean Machine Kavalauskas in his last fight. So that was, it's definitely a huge test. I was just looking at June and I'm thinking a lot of the fights I like are on undercards. I like the Triple G Rolls undercard. I like Charles Conwell against Skender Halili, who was in that, you know, fight of the year type thing a few years ago. That's a good test for Conwell. On the Fury Schwartz undercard, I like the Sullivan Barrera versus Jesse Hart fight. I think that's a tremendous fight.
Sullivan Barrera could really be kind of a show stealer kind of fight.
Right. Those are two brawlers that should, you know, who don't mind leaving their chin out there. So that'll be good. But we got the cruiserweight semis coming up in the World Boxing Super Series. Who do you see winning, Briedis and Glowacki?
I like Briedis to win there. I think Glowacki, I like watching Glowacki. I just think I think Briedis is a little more complete of a fighter. And I wasn't completely sold on him until I saw the Usyk fight. Right. And then you kind of saw, there's a lot there. He gave Usyk a real fight. One of the tougher ones Usyk has had. I think Glowacki is a little too one-dimensional, but he's physically tough. And he brings the fight all night. If nothing else, Glowacki can always look back and say he was in one of the greatest cruiserweight title fights of all time, right? Like whatever the fights are that are battling for second place after Holyfield Kawi, his fight with Marco Huck was that. So, you know, it was a hell of a scrap. But I like Briedis in that fight.
Yeah, I was surprised how much he struggled in the quarterfinals, Briedis. I actually didn't even think he won that fight, but we'll see if he returns to form against Glowacki. But who do you have in Dorticos versus Tabidi?
I don't know. Tabidi's look good. And, you know, he could be a dark horse to win the whole tournament. Dorticos is a veteran. I think Tabidi could sneak up on him there. Dorticos can be also, you know, a little bit predictable, in terms of his punch output. He's a 1-2 guy. I mean, it's super fundamentals, but Tabidi's younger. Dorticos has been in some real wars the last few years. And Tabidi feels like one of those real smart gambles that you make putting a kid in a tournament, giving him a chance to flourish on the backside. I like Tabidi in that fight.
No doubt. Just a few
and then
more.
Pacquiao Thurman is coming before the summer's over. So, you know, that's
right. Well, a couple more fights in June I wanted to ask you about. Aston Palicki and Kazuto Ioka for the Vacom Jr.
I like Kazuto Ioka big in that fight. I was surprised that Ioka lost to Nieves. I thought he might sneak up. I thought he might get past Nieves. Big credit to Donnie Nieves, who, you know, has been around for a lot of years and never really had sort of a win of the magnitude of Ioka. So good for him. I've seen Felipe a couple times. I saw him against Nieri. He's a good, solid fighter. Nothing that really jumps off the screen to impress you too much. I think Tezudo Iaoka is a little bit more well-rounded, a little more talented, and should be able to win that fight.
So a couple rematches going on later in the month. You got Andrew Cancio and Alberto Machado. Who do you think is going to win the rematch?
I think Cancio probably wins again. Forgive me, I can't remember. What division are they fighting in? Are they moving up, or is it a rematch for the title?
It's a rematch for the title, the junior lightweight title.
Yeah, I think Machado shouldn't be trying to make 130 pounds anymore, at least based on his frame and where he was in the last fight. I mean, he could certainly turn it around, but I would imagine Cancio could win that again. He's more designed to be at that weight class.
Right, right. How about another rematch here? Tony Harrison and Jermell Charlo. Who you see winning that rematch?
I thought Jermell won the first fight, but I think it was close. I thought it was competitive. Here's what we don't know. So in a vacuum, I would say I expect Jermell Charlo to win, but Tony Harrison is a talented guy, and it's the kind of fight where he could surprise us as one of those guys who gets better with a belt around his waist. We've seen that before, where guys get a little boost of confidence, get a little more comfortable in the ring, and then you find it's harder to beat them the second time around when they've already got a belt. So we'll see what happens. I mean, Harrison was giving Jared Hurd a hell of a fight before he got caught. Harrison is not an easy out fighter. So I like Charlo, but, you know, another upset there wouldn't surprise me. And, you know, maybe we end this year. We started this year talking about Jared Hurd versus Jermell Charlo, and we may finish the year talking about Julian Williams versus Tony Harrison. And that would be fascinating.
Right, right. That's boxing. It's crazy. Well, I guess two more here. Richard Comey and Ray Beltran. Do you think Beltran's just a little too used up, or do you think he could give Comey some problems?
No, I think Comey's going to look spectacular in that fight. Beltran is going to hang around. He's going to give it some rounds and be entertaining for the fans. But Ray Beltran is he's getting up there in age, and that's a lot of wear and tear on that frame. And I think Comey is hot. I think it'll be a good fight for him. He'll look good. And it gets him closer to a potential four-belt unification fight with Lomachenko later in the year, which would be fantastic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, listen, the thing about Comey, though, is he does leave that chin in the air, and Beltran's such a crafty veteran. I don't think that's going to be a blowout. I think it'll have some interesting moments in it, but I agree with you. Youth will be served in that one. We've got Demetrius Andrade and at the end of the month against Selecki for the WBO middleweight title. Selecki's given, you know, I mean, he's proven he's a top middleweight. How do you see that one going?
I think Demetrius Andrade probably wins that fight. I mean, Andrade's an interesting guy to watch in the ring. He had some funny, like, off performances early in his career that I think colored the way he was perceived. In terms of, you know, does he really want it? Does he have that fire? But when he's on in the ring, he's a very difficult fighter to beat. His schooling is and that amateur foundation and his length and his speed are difficult to deal with. And I just don't think he's going to lose right now. I think Andrade is focused on trying to get to the sort of big fight he hasn't yet to have had in his career. I mean, it's hard to believe he's been a pro a decade now. And yeah, I mean, the time is Andrade. I mean, you know, if he can't afford to lose now, and I think he'll realize that. I don't think we're going to I think it's going to take an elite level talent to kind of knock him off right now. I think the talent is there, and we might actually, you know, be ready to see him marry all that sort of potential and talent together.
All right. Well, hey, Cliff, I really appreciate you taking the time on a holiday weekend, and it was such a real pleasure to talk to you, and hopefully I'll see you at the fights one of these days.
Absolutely, yeah. I look forward to it, Kurt, and best wishes to you and yours, and hopefully we'll talk again in the future.
All right, sounds good. Take care, my man.
And that will do it for another edition of the Boxing Esquire podcast presented by The Ring and RingTV.com and distributed by the Leave It in the Ring Network. I'd like to thank Cliff Roll for taking the time out to speak with me. Really enjoyed that conversation. And if you like the podcast, please leave a comment or a rating on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Audioboom, SoundCloud, or wherever you access the Boxing Esquire podcast. I'd really appreciate it, as it helps new listeners find the podcast. And also, do not forget to check out my companion piece to this podcast on ringtv.com that features quotes and background on my interview with Cliff. So until next time, so long, everybody.
Did you get what you was looking for?